We're going to be looking at the text of Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2 shortly. But as we get there, there's a couple of quick reminders. We're not going to go in again as much depth as we did on the first night. But remember the hallmark principle, just like those hallmark movies. But the way you can think about it now is it's a mark in the hall of God's history that will show us where we need to go. What those various indicators do is they show us that God teaches the same message over and over again through different people, different places, and different times, but they all mark the path to the same end. That's Jesus and the kingdom. And so we're looking for those things. We're searching for them. We've looked at a couple of illustrations of this principle before, but now here's another one that I want to walk you through. I mentioned it in brief already, but it's two passages from the Old Testament that converge into the New Testament. The first passage is this. This is from Psalm 107, verses 23 through 32. And they tie together, and you can kind of keep this in your mind, an event upon the Sea of Galilee that's written down for us in Matthew chapter 14 and then Mark chapter 4. The text in Psalm 107 reads this way. Some went down to the sea in ships, doing business on the great waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, his wondrous works in the deep. For he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven. Then they went down to the depths. Their courage melted away in their evil plight. They reeled and staggered like drunken men and were at their wits' end. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. Then they were glad that the waters were quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of man. Let them extol him in the congregation of the people, and praise him in the assembly of the elders. Now, perhaps you've already begun to say, this sounds familiar. Well, walk along with me to the text of the Gospel of Mark, chapter 4. There in that text, it reads this way. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, let us go across to the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose. And the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a cushion. And they woke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased and there was great calm. He said to them, why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith? And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Now that ties one half of that picture or a hallmark for us. Now let's look at the other half. We're going to start actually now in the New Testament with it in Mark chapter 6. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. Now this is a key clause. He meant to pass by them. Mark 6:48. Now, this draws us a thread all the way back to the text of Exodus, which is our text for tonight, but it's going to be in chapter 34. In chapter 34, in verses 6 and 7, the scripture reads this way. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for the thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, the children's children, to the third and fourth generation. Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 and 7. Now, if you caught it, that picture is now all meshed together in what Jesus does in the presence of the disciples. He tried to pass them by, demonstrating that he was God. He calmed the anger of the storms, demonstrating that he was God. And all of that matches those hallmarks from the Old Testament text, from the Psalms and from Exodus. You may have heard, I've made mention of this before in sermons, and maybe you've heard someone say this as well, that there are somewhere at least 330 specific fulfilled prophecies concerning Jesus from the Old Testament found in the New Testament. Now, we're layering that with some of the larger pictures like this that we see here. It shows us that the story we're reading from the Old Testament, that's the story of Israel, is the story of Jesus, and really it's the story of you and me who have now been grafted into Jesus and grafted into Israel and really want to see heaven one day and return to that relationship that Adam and Eve had in the Garden of Eden at the connection nexus between the ground where man came from and the heavens where God resides. That's going to bring us to a passage that's pretty amazing. And so what we're going to be able to do then is hopefully more clearly see and understand this big message. Now let's see here. Right here for us, this is a view that we're going to kind of have in the corners of our mind. This is from modern Mount Nebo. So if you're remembering your Bible, it's a pretty important place for a number of individuals. In our particular case here, this is the furthest point we believe that Moses would have traveled to enter into the promised land. He would have seen it, but not been in it. Now, to you and I, we might see the modern conveniences of a very nice road driving through the mountains and a pretty dry area. And it really is, unless God blesses them with rain or the cycle of the seasons produce those rains. Otherwise, it's this dry, arid space. That's the area that they're going into. But you can't really see it very much past the edge, and it may be hard on your little screens, but that hazy section in the way back set part of it, it's actually really green, except for the sandstorm. I took this picture last year, and so the sandstorms are really persistent, and it's really hard to see how amazingly green it is. It's very similar, by the way, to the depth of green you see in the Nile Valley, which is full of agriculture. The soil in the Nile Valley area is incredibly dark and incredibly rich. It's black, has the pitch color that's really significant in their culture. So is a large section of the soil that's available in the richness side. The color browns out in Israel, but they're able to produce a tremendous amount of agricultural outcomes, date palms, nearly every fruit and vegetable you might think you want to find, they grow it there in person. The one thing you can't get a lot of in Israel fresh is basically cattle. The cattle industry is not very big there for all kinds of reasons, mainly because of the topography and land. But all your vegetable needs, all your fruit needs, and certainly all your sheep needs are certainly satisfied there in Israel. The reason that picture is up for us is that's part of our destination. This is where God is going to bring these people. But if you remember, our text is in Exodus chapter 20, and the story of God's people haven't moved that far just yet. Because the text here, as brought to us from the text of the ESV, reads, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." And what I'm going to do right now is try very hard to give a very brief rendition of what takes place between Genesis 12 and verse 3, the promise to Abraham, and arriving at the point where Moses becomes the person who carries the torch of God's victory forward. And so some of the things that happen there will become discussed as we go a little bit forward. There's a thing to think about, though, because this text in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2 really is the introduction to a larger component of the relationship of Israel. It's part of what is sometimes referred to as the Ten Commandments, which, by the way, aren't really ten. It's 10 words. The Decalogue is what we find in the Septuagint text for this same area. And that's also how it gets referred to through history. And in this case, this statement here really is a beginning of a sort. It's a reminder of a relationship, because in many of the simplest ways of the story that we're reading about, This is a summary of it. It's a story of redemption. You see, God's redemption is unfolding before us. And I mentioned how we're going to have to squeeze history together. There's a couple of people that are more important than others for the brevity of time. And I want to talk about Judah and Joseph for just a second. You may be familiar a lot with Joseph in Bible classes, particularly for the young folks, sometimes in series. We tend to look at Joseph primarily because of how God uses him. And we forget what happens to Joseph himself. His life is really tragic. Yes, he doesn't have the greatest relationship with his brothers. Being the youngest cousin slash brothers and brother in my family experience, being part of that littlest side of things, it took a while for those relationships to kind of balance out in my family life. His family life is a show lot worse. There's a lot going on. There's some serious favoritism there. God's already begun to identify him as a useful individual for his plan. He doesn't handle it well. His brothers don't handle it well. He ends up first in a pit. Judah kind of saves him. They kind of save his brothers, but his salvation then is to be sent into slavery. From slavery, he goes to pit. From pit, he goes to deeper pit. Finally, leveraging an opportunity to bring him into the palace of the most powerful person on the planet. He's able to understand dreams by some fashion or form. And God is attributed to the majority of that capacity. And so because of his use there, they build the storehouses. They provide the opportunity for two things to happen. Not only does Joseph provide the means to save his family, he actually averts tragedy for all of those families. Because if you remember in that story, every single nation in that region came to Egypt to buy the food that was stored up because God led him into that place, but they also sold themselves to do it. They all became slaves, and eventually Joseph's family will become slaves too. But at the lowest point of that story, the Joseph that we've had going step by step forward seems to be lost into who he is. He's married off into the Egyptian families. His attire has changed. He no longer acts like his own people, doesn't dress like his own people. He is covered in the garments of a priest of Egypt. And as I mentioned last night, he's so hidden in this new identity, his brothers can't recognize him. They don't know who he is. He's lost to them. You could even suggest perhaps that he is lost to himself. But in that moment of reconciliation, his brother coming to grips with what was done to him in the past and opening up about it allows Joseph also to tear down those barriers, and both of them are redeemed. And that brings us to Moses, who, by the way, is redeemed not once but twice. He is redeemed as a child and saved that way. But God redeems him from the wilderness and brings him back to where he needs him to be so that he can do the thing that we're going to talk about significantly tonight, to bring redemption for Israel. In Exodus 6, in chapter 6, verses 6 through 8, the story of redemption starts to percolate to its potentials. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with acts of great judgment. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will bring you into the land that I swore to give you to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord. In order to see the power of this statement, I need to tell you a little bit, just a small portion, of some of the aspects of the way in which the Egyptians in the ancient Near East, in the time of Joseph, in the time of Moses, saw their world. The world that they saw included a spiritual realm, much like you and I might think about. We often forget the fact that every person in the Bible believes deeply in the reality of the gods that they serve. It doesn't matter whether we believe those things are true. They most certainly did. And for the Egyptians, a big cycle of their life was the concept that they were the center of the universe, and their gods, including Ra, the god of the sun, would rise and set every day over their empire. Now, that's only important for us for one key point to understand right now. The doorways into the heavenly realms and the spiritual realms were beyond the Nile. And so what Moses is going to ask the Pharaoh to do, in essence, when he says, let my people go, we want to go after sacrifices in the wilderness, is in essence, I want to offer sacrifices to Yahweh, to Elohim, at the door of your God. You ever wonder why they got so upset so quickly and they weren't more agreeable to trying to find a solution? Because it wasn't really like a negotiation. Moses and Jehovah had thrown down the gauntlet to defy the gods of Egypt and to declare that he was setting them free. That moves us forward to additional stories of redemption. Now, keep that overarching picture of what they all thought they owned. That's all the backdrop, because God is going to pull them out of it. And when he pulls them out, we're going to see how this redemption continues to tell us what God is going to do with them and for us. It continues out of this same perspective of Exodus 20 and verse 2, because he's the God who brought them out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. The scriptures show us that it's approximately a three-month period from the Red Sea, or in some texts it renders it the Reed Sea, to Sinai. And that brings us to a text that's probably also familiar to us. It comes from Deuteronomy now in chapter 6. There it reads in verse 20, when your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders and great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and against all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are to this day. The Decalogue, then, the Ten Commandments, extends from that understanding of whom Israel is. They are a redeemed people. And now we're going to see what God's intention was for them, also from this same core set of texts. We need to think about, why did God choose to rescue this people out of slavery? Well, there's a couple of key truths in the scriptures. Obviously, it's in response to their groaning. In Exodus chapter 2 and verses 23 through 25, the Bible reads, during those days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew that they needed to be redeemed. So he remembered his covenant from Abraham and forward. And two, because he had compassion for their suffering. They were oppressed. They were beaten down. In Egypt, they had moved from being a prized guest to a prized possession. And God's faithfulness was woven into his covenant promise that those blessings that were to become through him needed to move forward. And so past, future, and present, God has a plan for them. Well placed in the future, but their present, right where they are at this point in time in their history in Exodus, really depends on God moving forward with that commitment. If you think about the text that leads into chapter 20, and this is back in Exodus 19, the scripture reads this way. Moses went up to God. Remember, Moses went up on the mountain. The God called to him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell to the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be a king of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. The very first thing that God does to remind the people of God's intention or initiative in saving them is to say, like, remember what I did. This is the energy expended toward the Egyptians so I could carry you out on eagle's wings and bring you to me. And on the one hand, the universal perspective, God's view from the top of Mount Sinai, as it were, is globally facing. The whole of the earth and all of the nations are important to him. But right here, the focus is now more on Abraham and his people. This is the God of Abraham. He had just rescued that nation out of slavery in order to rescue all people out of slavery. And he's going to build a relationship with them like a family, one that will be knit together. And you notice in the New Testament, a key factor of our connection to Christ is that you and I are adopted as siblings. We're not second class. We're equal in that relationship. And so God is continuing to rebuild his family. And then we see in the text a hint at something even greater, a covenant. When we think about the covenants that exist in the Bible, there's a number of them. And I want to just kind of hit a couple of key of concepts of them, because there's really two major covenants in the Old Testament text. There's a promise to Noah, a covenant specifically worded out, a promise of life to all the earth. In essence, in that relationship, he's never going to destroy the earth by water again, and life will spring forth from what comes afterwards. But the second great covenant that exists with Abraham is that they're going to be a great nation, that they will be blessed with land, and that through them, all the nations of the earth will know blessing through his seed. That brings us to this Sinai covenant, which is a little bit different. I want to kind of show you something that is important to understand that. In the ancient Near East, when treaties take place, it's a lot different than how we make agreements in some ways today. A typical practice for them was to do this. They would make two copies of a document. Let's say you have nation A and nation B, and they've been at war, and now they've negotiated a settlement, and nation A has won because they're mighty and powerful, so nation B is going to pay a tax and be subservient. Two copies of a treaty. They will be signed, and then they'll be stored where? In the temples of the major gods of those nations. But Israel is doing a covenant too. But there's not two nations, and there's not two gods. We sometimes look at those tablets there, and we have a picture that says, well, it must have been so long that they had to write it out on both two pieces. The picture, though, seems to match from history that you might think about it this way. There are two copies, because it's a contract between two parties. But what's different is there's only one God. So where do they get stored? In the ark, to be with God, who ratified both sides of the covenant. It's a great picture to understand in that commitment that God is both the beginning and end of their pledge in that covenant. And the heartbeat of that relationship might even be found in the text of Exodus chapter 6 and verse 7. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. From beginning to end, there is a mutual commitment that God is making to them and that they are making to Yahweh, to the Elohim who has made all things. Then we have the outcome of Moses being on the mountain. When Moses goes up on the mount, God's law is given to him. The law itself is really interesting. And I think we sometimes struggle with the concept of law when we read it in the Old Testament, because we think law then immediately means whatever we've decided law means now. Although we're not very consistent with it. But we tend to think of it that way. But in the Old Testament, and even to those who seek to follow Jewish or Old Testament worship today, law for them is a word that is Torah. And it doesn't mean law in the way that we use it, in the sense of statutes and legislation. It means teaching or guidance. It's course correcting rather than course crushing. And within that concept and that treaty that they have built is that God is guiding them to more and greater. So in the Decalogue, which we've kind of been hinting at, recorded in two places in the Old Testament for our perspectives, Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5, those texts there lay for us the prologue, the beginning point of what would then be the covenant, because the covenant is actually recorded for us in Exodus 20, verses 22 through chapter 23 and verse 33. That's a book in and of itself within a book that really lays out all the attributes of the covenant. And they're described in ways that are similar, more closely aligned with case law in American civil jurisprudence, describing typical situations of dispute, damage, assault, negligence, accidents, and so on. That's where the covenant is found. But the Decalogue that enters into it describes a picture of relationship. By the way, Leviticus and Deuteronomy expand on those things. Leviticus shows a relationship of service in the priests and a wonderful story that shows a number of the relationship aspects that will be important for the people to be holy as people of Yahweh. Deuteronomy gives us a collection of understanding a second repetition of the law. Because all of those, and this is something I think is really important to identify right here, that entire process is a celebration of God's mercy. Because it began with a reminder that he had been merciful to them. This is a point where when you're thinking about what God has done, you have 4 points on the screen. Hopefully you guys can all see them and they can all fit there. God's redemption, his intention, his covenant, and his law. These are things that demonstrate the kind of grace that we need, the steadfast love that we need. In the New Testament, Paul pulls from a Greco-Roman construct of grace. That Greco-Roman construct of grace is triple in nature. That grace received should be grace extended and then grace shared so that it can go and make a full circle through a community. It's nothing new to the Greco-Roman culture because it's very similar to the Old Testament relationship of grace, that you should be gracious because God is gracious, and then you go and be gracious. It's a very similar concept. But we don't always notice those cycles when we're looking at the text and for other purposes in other ways. But this law celebrates the deep grace of God. And here's something to think about. It's one of the Psalms. And I'm just going to read a bit from Psalm 19 tonight. This is Psalm 19, and we're going to begin in verse 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold. They are more pure than gold. They are sweeter than honey, than even honey from a comb. Now, I want you to think about what you see there and put that in contrast to whatever your perception is of what the Old Testament life would have been like. Oh, all these rules and regulations, all these things they have to do and can't do, and they've got to treat the land this way and do this over there. It just seems so burdensome. Where's the mercy and where's the love? Remember this. There is a difference between what God taught and what people do. God taught grace. People developed rules, regulations, and boundaries in excess to what God taught. And it was heightened to the very furthest degree when Jesus walked the earth. The Pharisees and the Sadducees were really good at doing just that, going beyond the law or going underneath or over the law to get whatever it is they wanted. Again, there's a big difference between what God taught and what people do. God was gracious and continued to be gracious. For think of this, the great King David. He's a great king, right? Absolutely. but he was also an adulterer, a murderer, a liar, both before he was king and after he was king. And even in his adult old age, his wonderful appointed son, Solomon, so wise and great as we think of him, conspired with his mother to ensure his appointment to be the next king. If you want to trouble yourself with what God was gracious with, think about David and Solomon. They were appointed into the roles, and we think they're wonderfully perfect, and they're wonderfully flawed, just like you and me. Because they were looking for the same thing we were, a king that was really worth something, a king named Jesus. So these people were then shaped for a mission. The people of Israel, if you go back and think of that picture on the edge of the promised land, they're getting ready for that, even though they don't even know what that is. And at times the view of it was so narrow and so small, they couldn't even begin to glimpse. They long to know what you and I know as insight into the mystery of Christ. Because this holy nation wasn't a nation at all. Can you imagine what it was like the first time you got together to worship according to God's pattern? And that was the first time? And that all took place in the wilderness? Everything was new to them. They were not yet a nation. And even through going into the conquest in Joshua's day, if you reread that last speech of Joshua, it has a tone of sarcasm to it. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. He was foretelling the future, because it really was just he and his house that served the Lord that produced Boaz, because everybody else went to the nations around them. It wasn't a rally cry. It's almost a complaint and a wailing. Each of these things, though, underneath God's law, his covenant, his purpose and intention for them and their redemption, are reflections of whom God is and what God wanted us to become. Here's a typical example of this picture kind of being played out so we can understand what God is trying to accomplish. And this comes in part from Deuteronomy chapter 15. So we can see this graciousness in practice. When an Israelite householder releases a Hebrew slave under the statutory 6-year release law, he is to give the slave a generous redundancy package of grain, animals, and wine to see him on his way. Why should he do that? Here's the instruction or reason for it. And when you release him, do not send them away empty-handed. Supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your wine press. Give to them, catch it, as the Lord your God has blessed you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God has redeemed you. There should have been a culture of redemption rather than a culture of punishment in Israel. And Moses stresses to Israel, they're not only to emanate what God has done for them, but also reflect the character of God as they do it. Now, that's all idealistic because we know the rest of the story. We know that there was a significant factor of failure in all the things that happened next for them. However, God assured them consistently, even in Deuteronomy, that judgment is going to be combined with hope beyond judgment, because Yahweh would still be the God of grace, still be the God of love, and still be the God of forgiveness, because he's going to enable them to seek him with all their heart and with all their soul, to love him and obey him, and to continue to ask that they turn back to him, to choose life and not death. Now, with all that as our backdrop, I want to turn our eyes forward to Paul. Are we now surprised any more than God was that the law itself could not make sinners and rebels good and perfect? But the fault was not in the law, but the people. That's why God talks about the law being powerless, because it was weakened, but not just by the flesh, by my flesh and our flesh. He's talking about that in Romans chapter 8 and verse 3. That's why the Israelites found that the law brings them death. It exposed their sin, but it also brings them under God's curse and judgment. But it wasn't a new discovery for Paul. The law always had said that. Nor was it a new discovery for Paul. It was a new realization for him that God had also planned a hope beyond that. And that ultimately led to Jesus. And that ultimately is what Paul saw on the road after he was blind then he could see. I hope you've gotten something more out of a look at this text right here from Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2. It's not just the preamble to the Decalogue. It's a statement that encapsulates the entire mission that Israel will be on from that day until John, the last prophet of the Old Testament. Because these redeemed people are the foundation for the redemption of all people.